Have you ever felt so overwhelmed with the stress and pressure of the complicated business details surrounding the planning for a loved one to enter long-term care? Have you ever felt the pressure of being unprepared and faced with the final planning and arrangements for funeral or memorial services of a loved one? Have you ever been so overwhelmed by the details surrounding estate planning and estate settlements and so forth? If so, stay tuned to learn how you can be best prepared and have a plan when we find ourselves faced with the pressures of personal end-of-life challenges.
Welcome to Planning for Tomorrow. We take life's most difficult questions, concerns, and challenges and turn them into manageable nuggets of information so that you can make the best decisions when you are planning for tomorrow. You can contact us at pftradio@gmail.com. You can check us out on Facebook, Planning for Tomorrow Radio, or if you're calling from the local listening area, 304-399-8255, or long distance, 877-420-8255.
And welcome to Planning for Tomorrow. And regular listeners will know this, that every other Friday, rather than doing Viewpoint with Gene Dean, we have Planning for Tomorrow with Fred Kitchen, who's here in the studio.
Good morning, Fred. Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. And usually we have a guest, and that's no exception this morning.
Absolutely.
We do have a guest, and I'm delighted to welcome lawyer attorney Bruce Stout, who is a professional in the area of estate planning. So, Bruce, thank you so much for being with us.
Happy to be here.
I know that you've been with me before, even on Viewpoint, to talk about estate planning, but we're going to get into it in depth some more this morning, and both Fred and I have a copy of your book here in front of us, Estate Planning in West Virginia, which is really comprehensive.
Yes, it is.
I hardly recommend it to anyone. So, Fred, why don't you start off with a question here?
Well, you know, Bruce, a lot of times, like Gene was saying about the show here a little bit, we've been talking about wills. We've been talking about all kinds of end-of-life planning for some time. And we thought it would be great to have you in here since you had this book. And it specifically talks about West Virginia, which is where we're focused. And here's a question for you right here, and see if you can help us have a little understanding. This was a question that actually somebody gave me. And it happens quite frequently where I do work in a funeral home setting where we are faced with this. But this was asked to me. Parents have individual insurance policies, let's say. Okay, and they're not revisiting their personal assets, whether it be their will, they're not going back and making adjustments to that, but life changes are happening. And say dad has an insurance policy and he makes mom the beneficiary. Kids are too young at that time. And then mom does the same thing. She makes dad the beneficiary. Well, dad passes away, so mom's able to be able to handle everything with the assets there. But in the event that mom passes away and she had made no changes to that, what is the process that somebody's going to have to go through as far as an estate to be able to process that?
Well, the contingent beneficiary in that situation would be laid out in the policy itself. It's usually either paid to the estate and thereby passes by the will, or some policies automatically just go to the intestacy provisions, which would be what would be applicable if the person died without a will. In either case, the lack of planning there may result in a situation that the insurance goes to somebody you don't want it to go to.
Absolutely.
Let me give you a more egregious example. Let's say that you have a husband and wife, and the husband names his wife and then his children. The husband and wife get divorced. There's no effort to change that policy, beneficiary designation. Even though under his will, his former spouse, provisions for her, both in a testamentary manner and a fiduciary manner, would be automatically revoked under the statute. That's not the case with the life insurance.
So she would still be?
She'd still get it.
Wow.
And then there's going to be an argument about whether that's what he really wanted, all the rest, and probably only the lawyers are going to benefit. But it's a classic example where people have to recognize that not only their will should be updated on a regular basis, but their so-called non-probate assets, those assets that don't pass by the will, like life insurance, retirement plans, joint with right of survivorship properties, revocable trusts, and other assets should be reviewed as well.
Now, Go ahead.
That's extremely interesting to me because a member of my family, a stepdaughter, actually is a lawyer in Ohio. And she had asked me or stated certain provisions that are in force in Ohio. And she said, did I say she's a lawyer?
Yeah.
she said, but I don't know what the law is in West Virginia. So I'm particularly pleased that you have written your book, Bruce, as just for the law in West Virginia. I think that's enormously helpful because the laws do change from state to state, don't they?
Dramatically. And, in fact, Ohio is one of the states where a life insurance policy, the beneficiary would be automatically revoked in the event of a divorce. So just there you see the difference. In terms of the book, you're correct that its sole focus really is West Virginia law. We are working on putting out one for Ohio and one for Kentucky, but we're not there yet. But this one, I started this book with putting all three states, and it ended up being so jumbled and so many differences that I thought it was sort of incomprehensible. So I just went with each state will have a separate
one. Oh, I think that's a good idea.
That's one of the things that we've talked about in the past on the show is where we border Kentucky, Ohio,
right,
and then we're in West Virginia. We've talked about nursing home care and how even the laws regarding that and passing of assets and things like that's even different from state to state.
Fundamentally different.
And of course, you specifically mentioned life insurance, and that's always a big deal.
Yeah, and one of the things that I would like to ask you, we talked about going back and revisiting these issues, you know, the will and making these changes and updates. How often should somebody look at these assets and look at these documents and update them?
Well,
life changes.
Yeah, I think what we say is every 3 to 5 years.
Okay.
And I think as people get older, it becomes closer to three. If they're relatively young folks, I'd say probably every five.
Mm-hmm.
When people have children, grandchildren, divorces, increase or decrease in assets, all those kind of things are triggers for taking another look at it and making sure that you have exactly what you want.
Right. Okay. Good.
Yeah.
That's good.
That,
good information.
That is very good to know. And I do hope you'll let us know just as soon as your books on Ohio and Kentucky come out.
We will.
Well, I think that's a real interesting point to talk about there with the life insurance, too, and that not being changed with a spouse that may be an ex now.
Right.
And, you could be leaving them something that may not have been your intent all along. So, I mean,
probably wouldn't be your intent.
No, it wouldn't be.
Right.
So all the more reason.
It's possible, of course, that the divorce proceeding would take care of that in a final order, but more often than not, it's not as specific as it needs to be to take care of that problem.
Right.
Okay. All right.
Wow.
Go ahead, Fred.
Well, another question I have here for you that I think would be relevant would be the estate has already been closed. Someone has already been named executor, executrix. They have closed the estate. They went ahead and all the bank accounts are closed and all those type of things, and a check shows up. For maybe a nursing home or something like that from care that had been money that had been in a care account, and it's now paid to that deceased. It's in that deceased individual's name, but everything's been closed out.
This is an asset coming in.
This is an asset coming in after the estate's been closed.
What you do there is you go to the courthouse, and you get to be appointed as executor, what we call executor for a day.
Okay.
And then you can simply endorse the check and run it through the account and give it to the proper beneficiaries.
Now, if there is no account, if the account's been closed, if the bank account's been closed?
Well, then you can simply cash the check
and
give it out.
As long as you're executor for a day to be able to transact that business.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Wasn't aware of that.
You also see that happen for stock certificates that come out of nowhere or life insurance or something like that. That's especially the case with people who don't have children.
Right.
Don't have anybody really watching their assets.
This recently happened with a family that we had cared for. And matter of fact, just last week, someone came in and says, okay, we have an issue. We've closed the estate. Everything's done. We thought, and this shows up in the mail. What do we do? It's in her name, and she's deceased.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So
it's estate administration generally is not a super complicated process. It's just the fact that it's new to someone. And obviously most people don't go through it more than once or twice in a lifetime.
Right.
And you know, every time they go through it, the laws have probably changed. So, you know, if you get a lawyer that does a fair amount of this, a lot of these things that seem insurmountable or even difficult can be easily taken care of.
Wow. Yeah, that's okay. Good. You want to take a little break?
Yeah,
here?
Let's take a commercial break and have a listen from our sponsors.
Right, okay. And welcome back to Planning for Tomorrow. Fred Kitchen is here in the studio, and our guest for today, attorney Bruce Stout, who is a professional and expert in the field of estate planning. And Bruce, I have a question for you. Checking accounts were mentioned just a few minutes ago. How long should one keep open the checking account belonging to a deceased person? Is there any rule that we should follow?
Well, I think what you normally do is you combine all the accounts into one estate account.
Okay? Oh, okay.
And then that estate account would last for the period of the estate. And basically the way an estate would run is there's an appointment of the executor, assuming there's a will. If there's not, it's called an administrator. You file the appraisement. You have 90 days to do that, the appraisement inventory listing of all the assets of the estate. Then there is another 90-day period for claims, and then you go ahead and wrap it up with either a final accounting or what we call waiver or final settlement. Once that is done, then it's you distribute the assets. And
So really it's quite a period of time then. We're talking at least 6 months, would you say?
Generally 6 to 9 months. There also, if you have a pretty good handle on your expenses mm-hmm. of the decedent mm-hmm. and the expenses that are going to be generated by the estate, let's say somebody's been in a nursing home 2 or 3 years and you know what the expenses are. I mean, obviously mm-hmm. they weren't out driving, running over people, that kind of thing. Then I think what you can do is you can make advance distributions.
Okay.
So let's say you have $500,000 estate. You can give out $400,000 of it, and you only have $100,000 left to take care of whatever may come up. So mm-hmm. you can make that fairly quick in the process. So what I always tell people, especially you know, when a lot of times when elderly people die and their kids are getting older, or they wanted to go to their siblings or whatever, and those folks are getting older, I said, you know, it's your money. Let's get the money to you as soon as possible. Rather than hold on to it in the estate for no real purpose.
Okay.
West Virginia does not require, as some states do, a court proceeding to make an advance distribution, so that makes it easier.
Okay. Fred, you had a question relating to that, too, didn't
you? Yeah, and something else I'd like to say right here would be, if that person who was the executor or executrix in that situation that Gene was just talking about, if they would have been possibly the power of attorney that had been taken care of bills and things like that ahead of time even mm-hmm. for them, they're going to have a pretty good knowledge of what was involved in this estate.
Right, and even if they're not, they would have the ability just to go to the checked ledger and look at it. And generally, again, with folks that are fairly sedentary, they're the same pattern of bills every
right.
month.
Mm-hmm. We had a call come in just a little while ago, and a question was, what if a bill... an unpaid bill comes in after the estate has been closed, and maybe we can look at that both ways. Mm-hmm. A bill comes in prior to the estate being closed. How is that handled? And then a bill that would come in after we've closed all accounts and all those kind of
things. Let's assume the bill comes in and the estate's still open. Then the executor has 20 days to decide to pay it or not.
Okay.
If they decide to not pay it, then it goes to a hearing with a fiduciary commissioner. There are certain rules as to how that claim has to be presented. And the executor has a right to respond, and then you go to a hearing. That decision is made. If anybody wants to appeal it, it goes to the county commission. If you want to appeal it from there, it goes to the circuit court. If you want to appeal it from there, it goes to the West Virginia Supreme Court.
Okay.
I think that answers the question from Pete, who called in but didn't go on the air
yeah,
with us, but
right.
he was busy. But,
but let's go to the next one, though, and that
okay.
is where the estate's closed.
Afterwards, right.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm.
So if you have that scenario and the time period is run, then oddly enough, the creditor is not out. What the creditor can do is he can sue the beneficiaries directly.
Okay.
Now, that's going to require a circuit court hearing, mm-hmm. and, you know, I think the creditor has to weigh the cost of that. Mm-hmm. versus the amount of potential recovery.
What about protection for the executors who were executing that estate and that bill comes in afterwards and it's unpaid?
Are they at any type of liability for that? Let's say if they're not a beneficiary.
Not. They're not going to be liable, assuming they did all the right things, like make sure it got published in the paper in terms of the creditors and so forth.
Right.
There is one rule there that could get you hooked up, and that is that in today's world, if you have a known creditor, you have to send them notice specifically by mail. You can't just sort of hope they don't call.
Right, right.
And that's as a result of a U.S. Supreme Court case a number of years ago now. But so the law is fair. It's sort of both ways. If you're a known creditor, the law is fairly favorable to that known creditor. If you're if you're not a known creditor, then the time period is fairly short.
Okay.
90 days. Now, the other thing is, let's say you have an insolvent estate, okay, meaning the debts are greater than the assets. Then there is a priority in terms of payment, funeral expenses being right up there.
Right.
And
why are you
laughing, not surprisingly,
Bruce?
Attorney fees.
Yes.
And then things like unsecured creditors, such as credit cards and so forth, are way at the bottom. So a lot of times you get people who have so-called credit card claims, and they have been able to get away with it. One other point I'd make, and I don't want to beat to death the technicalities, but it used to be that if you had a revocable trust, you could put your money in that, and because that wasn't a probate asset, you could maybe scam the system by not having to pay the debts. That's no longer the case as a result of a bill passed in our legislature in this year. So now the revocable trust assets would also be part of the pot, if you will, where creditors can be paid from.
What all could be placed in an irrevocable trust? I know and of course, in my setting, we're talking about funerals, of course, final planning, you know, expenses.
Yeah, an irrevocable trust, of course, is a different animal in that it can't be changed. And if, let's take the simple one, where the grantor cannot benefit from it, then those assets are off the table.
Okay.
Now, if he can benefit from it significantly, then I think you're going to find that they're going to be includable back in the estate for various reasons, which I think fairly technical, we can let that go. But, you know, if on top of all that, you have what's called fraudulent transfers.
Right.
And so if certain transfers are made just to avoid creditors, that, especially within a certain period of time, isn't going
to
work.
Right. It's not necessarily a place to try to hide money.
Right.
And then hopefully that's returned back to you at some later point in time.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Okay. Absolutely.
Well, when you talk about creditors, and isn't there something, and I think you touched on this, Bruce, about a publication, a notice of publication?
Right.
And does that take care of the executor's responsibility or the administrator of the state's responsibility?
By and large, you've got, after the appraisement, you have the 90-day period.
Right.
And that's triggered by a notice in the paper.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Now, the executor also has the duty to send direct notice to known creditors, like we talked about a little bit earlier. So when you put those two together, you're moving towards, in effect, squashing the creditor's claims.
Okay, but how would you know who the deceased's creditors might be?
Well, if you go through their mail
and
they say, hey, you owe us,
okay.
You know, whatever,
okay.
that would be all those things. But if you don't know, then that's what the notice is to take care of.
Okay, all right. And I suppose if, for example, in the case of the death of a husband and the wife being the total sole beneficiary of his will, then that sort of plays into the situation, doesn't it?
Well, if you have either a sole beneficiary or what we call a small estate of under $100,000 of probate assets, you get to use what's called a short form or a simple form administration, which saves some wear and tear and some money in terms of the fiduciary commissioners.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly, if it's a sole beneficiary who's also the executor, then you know, she or he has complete control of the estate.
Bruce, you've been an attorney for a long period of time. Have you always specialized in estate planning? Has that always been your particular field?
That's correct. That's what I wanted to do in law school, and after a year or so, and I was fortunate enough to come here, went to High State in Columbus, and came down here, and was just incredibly lucky to work for Mr. Copen, Noel Copen, who was not just a great guy, but a great boss, great lawyer. I did find out later that the 12 guys who I think had been in the role before me all got fired. So I'm not sure I would have taken it knowing that, but I often wondered if he thought I was that great, or he just didn't want to go through the process again.
He just didn't want to fire you again.
Yeah, he just didn't want to have to go get somebody else.
We haven't, in fact, mentioned the fact that you are with the law firm of Huddleston Bolin right here in Huntington.
That's so, right. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
And before we take a break, let me follow up a little bit on this. What was it, Bruce, that really appealed to you in practicing estate planning? You said you wanted to do that from the beginning. Well, how was that?
Well, I guess I looked at it as what I was good at, and I was good at the tax courses and the property courses, and some of the classes like constitutional law that were a little hard for me to get my arms around. For example, at Ohio State, we spent literally all year in constitutional law talking about the desegregation case.
Oh.
And I kept sitting there thinking there's probably not going to be another one in Columbus. I don't know what we're doing here. That was part of it. And part of it was I thought, part of the reason I wanted to go to law school was to help people solve problems.
Okay.
And part of it was to sort of be at the front end, solve the problems before you ended up in court.
Well, you said they succeeded.
Yeah, you've done a good job with that.
That's great. We need to take a break here, Bruce. Can you stay with us?
Sure can.
All right, good.
Well, we'll be right back. You've been listening to Planning for Tomorrow
with our guest, attorney Bruce Stout, and our regular every other Friday guest, Fred Kitchen, and I'm Jean Dean, and this is Planning for Tomorrow. We'll be back right after the news and weather. And welcome back to Planning for Tomorrow. We are here in the WYVC SuperTalk studio, and sitting across the table from me, in case you don't recognize my voice, this is Jean Dean, who usually does Viewpoint with Jean Dean, but today we're doing Planning for Tomorrow.
I'm Fred Kitchen.
And Fred Kitchen is sitting across the table from me, and sitting next to me is attorney Bruce Stout, an expert on estate planning, and he is a local attorney with the firm of Huddleston Bolin. So let's carry on with our discussion here.
Well, one of the questions that Bruce and I was talking about a little while ago was let's say that mom and dad would divorce, or mom or dad passes away, but they had a will already in place to kind of protect the children, but yet they remarry. When they remarry, does anything change in that will now that they have a new, I guess that would be the legal next of kin?
Mm-hmm. So we're looking at a situation where we recognize that if they get divorced, the provisions for a former spouse, both dispositive, in other words, getting money, and fiduciary, executor.
Yeah, please put it in every
language. Let's keep it simple.
Right.
Yeah.
Are taken out. Now, if you marry, that doesn't revoke your will.
Right.
Now, and if you give it to just children, you're fine. Now, there's two issues, though, that come up. One is if you don't have a prenuptial agreement, then your spouse at your death would have the right to elect against your will.
Okay.
Now, what they take would be dependent on how long you've been married and the assets of both the husband and wife. So it's hard to give an exact answer to that, but it certainly is something that should be considered in every upcoming marriage.
So if they were married just like, say, for 5 years until that death occurred, then the assets that they acquired together is probably not going to be as much. Is that what you're kind of saying, or am I missing?
No. No? Let's say you have a situation where they've been married 5 years.
Okay.
Let's say the husband has $1 million, just to make it simple, and the wife has none.
Okay.
And it's at 5 years, it's about 15 to 20%. Let's call it 20%. I'd have to double check the statute. Let's say it's 20%. Well, she would then walk away with $200,000.
Okay.
And the rest of it would go to the children. So that's a result that you may or may not want. You can curtail that result, if not eliminate it, by having a prenuptial or postnuptial agreement.
Okay.
One other scenario there is, let's say you don't have children or you haven't named your children. So let's say you name Marshall University as your sole beneficiary and you remarry and you don't change your will. Well, then your wife, the new wife, is what we call a pretermitted or omitted spouse. In other words, she was omitted from the will because she, in effect, wasn't around when that was done.
Okay.
That gives her a certain level of standing. And in a situation where it all goes to somebody other than the children, or whatever amount doesn't go to the children, let's put it that way,
okay,
she would be able to take her intestate share. And her intestate share under those facts, as it compares to either Marshall, who's of course not an heir, or a brother or somebody like that, she would be entitled to 100%. And so that could be a dramatically different result. So what I would say, and in fact I'm writing an article on this, the Family Law Bar asked me to write an article about the interface, if you will, of estates and estate planning and divorce and remarriage. I think that it is simply one of those life-changing events,
right,
a new marriage, to decide what it is you want to do, mm-hmm, whether you want a prenuptial agreement, whether you don't, how do you want to plan, let's say, for your children versus her children.
Right, that's what I was going to say. I mean, you got two sets of children on both sides.
And remember, too, that when you talk about children, stepchildren are generally not defined as children. Now, adopted children are, illegitimate children are in today's world, but not stepchildren.
Wow.
So if you want stepchildren to take, you'd have to be specific on that.
Okay.
You're throwing out big figures here. You're talking about million-dollar estates.
Mm-hmm.
And even the term estate planning might lead some people to believe that, well, I don't have a lot of money, I don't own a lot of property, maybe I don't own any property, I don't have very much in an estate. But, Bruce, is it not still very important that a person make a will? Otherwise, things are not going to go the way they want them to.
Even if they have a small amount of assets.
Even if it's really small, yes.
And one of the things, I would say is, in today's world, the tax situation is not particularly important to most Americans, most West Virginians. On the federal level, the exemption is $5 million right now. It may change after the next election, but that's where it is right now. And West Virginia doesn't have an estate tax at all and hasn't since Arch Moore changed that in 1985. But nonetheless, if you have assets, if you don't make that decision to have a will, guess who decides? It's the state statute. These are the same people that can't fix potholes. Now you're going to let them decide where your money
what they're
going
to do with your assets. That's
low,
right.
Low.
Well, you know, fair one, I would argue. But I guess then the question is, wherever you want it to go, you can decide that. The only person you can't cut out is a spouse.
Okay.
And beyond that, you have pretty much testamentary freedom. You can cut your children out. You can even cut your children out if they're minors, which
But you can't not include a spouse.
You have to include a spouse.
Oh.
Wow. But you can exclude children.
Children, even minor children.
Right.
And grandchildren, whatever. You can exclude anybody but a spouse.
Pays to be good to mom and dad.
Stepchildren are automatically excluded?
They are. Well, let's go back. Stepchildren are not heirs.
Okay.
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 And so if you want them to take under your will, and again, you can have anybody take under your will you want, friends, non-relations, whatever,
mm-hmm,
and then you can go ahead, so you can put stepchildren in.
So we're initially kind of following bloodline, what we're doing, really.
That's exactly what we're doing.
Well,
if you think about it, the law of intestacy is simply the idea of what would most people want.
Right.
And most people would want it go to their children and so forth. However, there are states now looking at the question of stepchildren because that is such a huge change in the last 30, 40 years that arguably the law has to catch up on that.
What do you do when somebody has, and excuse me if anyone listening has actually done this, but if you have what I would consider a kind of a weird will, like leaving everything you have to your cat or your dog or something like that? I mean, those, I suppose, can be protested in court if there's family members.
Well, any will can be contested, and let's go back on as to how that would happen. The person would have to be deemed either incompetent, mm-hmm. and incapacity to execute a will is fairly limited. I mean, you don't have to go to Harvard. I mean, you basically have to know what your assets are,
right?
Who your family members are,
mm-hmm.
That you're in the process of doing a will, mm-hmm. and you have a plan. And the plan can be, I want to give it to this child and cut this child out. That's a plan.
Okay.
Right? Now, undue influence, which means somebody has sort of taken over you mentally, and they're driving what you want in the will, and of course, mm-hmm. they're going to be the major, if not sole beneficiary,
sure.
or the will is not properly executed, and then you sue the lawyer. But but going back to the, because it's important, a lot of people are interested in trust for animals.
Mm-hmm.
In this law that we talked about earlier that was passed in this session, for the first time, the law is clear in West Virginia that you can have a trust set up for an animal. And there are issues that you need to think about there. But one of the things that I'm not comfortable with in the statute, it says you can put as much money in the trust for the animal as is necessary to, in effect, take care of the animal. Well, what does that mean? What I'm going to try to, a couple of us on the probate committee are going to try next session to get some kind of safe harbor. In other words, if it's $25,000 or less, then nobody can challenge it.
Okay.
Because you're right, there are so-called animal wills do have a higher level of challenge.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is people on their deathbed have a higher challenge if there's a dramatic change from what they had before. I'd also say same-gender couples have a high degree of, there can be a high degree of contest, so they have to be especially careful.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever had to deal with a situation where somebody has left a lot of money to Fluffy or Snoopy? Or
Yeah, I have. And oddly enough, in a couple situations, these were both in Ohio, and Ohio has more of a statutory and a case law to support it back then, the family didn't complain.
Really?
They said that's what she really wanted to do, and mm-hmm. You know, they got a little bit, and they were happy with it. And one of the things you got to think about, though, is who's going to get the money after the animal dies?
Right, and $25,000 that you mentioned is going to take a lot.
Right, absolutely.
Feed a lot of cat food or dog food.
Bruce, I've got a couple other questions I'd like to ask you when we come back from a break. Let's take just a quick break and have a listen from our sponsors. You're listening to Planning for Tomorrow.
Something.
And we are back. You're listening to Planning for Tomorrow. And, you know, I want to get back to what Bruce was talking about here with the pets here in a little bit, Gene.
Okay.
But I'd like to mention something real quick, if I could, since we're coming back from break. I'd like to take just a minute and talk about the healing field that is coming to Huntington, West Virginia, an incredible event that will be at Spring Hill Cemetery. And, gosh, I mean, this is going to be a neat thing for our area.
Oh, it is. In fact, we had Kevin Brady on the air
right. And
talking about that, and I do want to encourage people. You don't have to be a corporate sponsor. You mm-hmm. can buy your own for $35.
Right, you can. And here's the thing. There's going to be 3,000 flags placed in Spring Hill Cemetery, and this is honoring all those who lost their lives during 9/11. The World Trade Center towers, the Pentagon, and, you know, we had some loss here in the local area.
Yes, we did. Paul Ambrose.
And you know what? I think this is a great thing for our area to get involved in. And I think they're going to be starting to set those flags up this Saturday. It'll go all week long. There's events to be planned all week long. And you can go to our Planning for Tomorrow website, thepftradio.com. We'll have information on there
about the healing field and how you can get involved, or if you just want to go by and just kind of be part of the ceremonies.
Right. And it's not too late to buy one of the flags to just contact the Park Board office, I would think, and that number is 696-5954, and they'll be able to tell you how you can get your own flag. And you can make it in memory of somebody, too,
You definitely can. So, you know, be a part of that. And I'd also like to just take a minute and say thank you to our sponsors that make this program possible every other week. Designs by DJ on East Pea Ridge in Huntington, the Barbersville area there, Oaklawn Cemetery on East Pea Ridge in Huntington, and Henson Mortuary. Without those sponsors, the show would not be possible, and we've got to really say thank you to them for supporting us in bringing this information, like Bruce is talking about today, bringing it to the tri-state area. There's nothing like this as far as a free resource to be able to at least get us some information. And, you know, the whole purpose of this show is about planning. And we talked about that a little while ago, Bruce. There's a lot of people that just the reason why that they're in a lot of the situations they're in, or the insurance situation we talked about, we referenced, the reason why that those things happen is because there wasn't a plan in place. There wasn't proper planning. So that's the important part of all this.
Yeah, and even while it's fair to say that, you know, thinking about doing your will is not, you know, always the most exciting thing. It obviously,
we're a little superstitious. We think if we do it, it's going to happen.
You know, I had somebody one time who didn't do on a will. They wanted to do a living trust. That way they figured they'd never die.
It sounds like it might. But
But it is something you have to face, and it's just a question of being, you know, handling problems. One group that I think really needs to deal with it are young people who have small children.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right.
To me, if you don't name a guardian, you're looking at parental malpractice. I've had situations where that didn't happen. I end up being a guardian ad litem in court, and, you know, we've been within inches of naming a guardian, a court, who, in this one case, had numerous accusations of child molestation.
Mm. Oh, dear.
And so, you know, that would have been a disaster.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. And the parents know better about their family and who's good and who wouldn't be in terms of that situation than anybody else, and so they really should get that and take care of it.
So what happens if, for example, if both parents die at the same time and there are minor children, who comes in at that point and takes care of them?
Well, what happens is you have to have a hearing.
Oh, okay.
And the number of people is usually directly proportional to the amount of money in the estate.
Right.
Okay.
And they then squabble over who's going to be appointed, and a judge makes a decision probably after a half-hour hearing, which is very, very difficult. And it's really not fair to the judge, because how can he really determine that?
Mm-hmm.
So, and if the children are 14, well, if they're 14, they have a pretty strong vote. But even before that, a lot of times judges will at least listen to them in terms of, you know, are you adamantly opposed to this person or that person, and why?
Mm-hmm. Why?
But, you know, it's traumatic enough for a child to have their parents pass away.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
On top of that, they end up going to somebody that was never really blessed, if you will, by their parents as the person to take care of them. I think that makes a bad situation even worse.
Yes.
And it simply doesn't have to be that case. The other thing is, young parents need to think in terms of when they're if the money comes to their children, when do they want it to come to them?
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Most people would agree that a child should not be getting large amounts of money at 18.
Mm-hmm.
My son, Austin, if that's, you know, if he gets the money at 18, which is where he is right now, it's just going to help the car dealers. It's not going to help
Absolutely.
Anybody else. And maybe a couple girls in the tri-state. But anyway, you know, so people need to think about what type of trust and so forth would be the best. And that's not always just limited to young you know, teenagers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
There are people who are adult children who can't handle money.
Right.
No.
And so then you have to think about what kind of trust you want for them. I had one, you can also put conditions on it.
Okay.
A simple condition would be, for example, I had a fellow who was an engineer, but he wouldn't work. And his mother said, you know, this is driving me crazy.
Yeah.
But, you know, deep down I know I'm going to keep taking care of him till I die, but I want him to work after I go.
Mm-hmm.
And so we set up a trust that said he got four times, every year, four times what his earned income was.
Wow.
Oh.
So he had to be doing something in order to
right.
get it.
That's a good one.
So that is a good one.
He had to be acquainted with the concept of earned income, but once we got over that hurdle, he cut the ponytail and went to work for the Corps and did a good job.
The rest is history. Huh?
Yeah, the rest is history.
Well, you know, I think that brings up a good point. We have, as parents, you have a huge responsibility, especially to minor children.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and I, you bring up a good point. My wife and I, several years ago, a company that I was working for, I had a trip that we were going to go on to Mexico. And I, at that time, I probably had a four-year-old and a two-year-old, or it was probably a five-year-old and a two-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had that was something we had to look at because, you know, we started
sure.
thinking we're both going to be on an airplane at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want to think about it, but it's the reality of how are we going to prepare for our children if something would happen? And we had to actually do that. It was our responsibility to them to make sure that we did that, and we knew that we were putting them in a home that would be able to distribute the finances to that would best suit them, number one, and not suit the person that actually would be taking care of them as the guardian, and then also just make sure that they're getting the care.
And when you think about the guardian, you really have to think about who would be the best person. And too often people fall into sort of the easy choices, which are not always the best choices. For example, Michael Jackson, the pop singer, who did he name for his children that were like 12, 13, 14? He named his mother.
Right.
His mother was in her 70s.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not going to work.
Mm-mm.
And then beyond that, if possible, even made a worse choice for the contingent, and that was Diana Ross. And, you know, what rehab center is she in now?
Right.
You know, so.
He wasn't really known for making great choices.
No, that's
you know,
right.
So.
Mike had his issues.
Yeah,
so,
he did. Very talented.
But one of the things I think is people tend to go with their parents, and that may or may not make sense depending on the age of the parents.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing is they tend to name their siblings sort of as a default position,
right.
Where they would be better off probably naming somebody. I mean, our relatives are our relatives. We may love them, but they may not have the same values as we do.
Right.
You may want to name a friend, but you have to watch out for that because then it's coming back the other way.
Yeah.
If they have kids, you're going to have them, and you have to decide whether you want
it's
to take
tough,
on that
it's
responsibility.
It's a tough thing to think about.
You have to think about that, even naming the executor in your will.
Right.
Because what's the point of naming somebody as old as you? Because they may die before you. So.
And the other thing you got to think about in terms of naming the executor is not just the first one, but who do you want as a backup?
Oh, you can have a backup?
Yeah, you need to have a backup.
Okay.
What if that person dies
what
before
you
do?
Yeah. Okay.
Next thing you need to think about is, do you want that person to have a fee?
Oh.
Let's say you had three children, and you name one of them as executor, and they get a fee, and that fee is just says reasonable compensation or whatever, and then they pull down, let's say it's a fairly large estate, let's say they pull down $25,000. Well, don't think that's not going to come up at the next Thanksgiving dinner with the kids, and you're gone.
Absolutely.
Now, if you put in $5,000 or it's clear that the parent made the decision as to how much, I found that children can live with that.
Okay. Yeah.
Let me ask you a quick question. We're running out of time.
Almost out of time.
We are, but I got a quick question I just want to see if we can kind of get into quickly. Parent entering a nursing home. We've talked about this in the past, but a parent entering a nursing home going to have to go on Medicaid. How do we protect those assets? Can we do that a quick rundown?
Sure. There's a couple of things we can do, and this is an area that is getting tougher by the day because the government's deficit issues. You're seeing, and I don't want to put a political spin on it, but there's more and more talk about living wills because we all know that a huge amount of money is expended in the last year of life.
Right.
So we're I guess the sense is we're trying to reduce that. In terms of transferring assets, you have to remember that now we're up to 5 years.
Right.
So for the first 5 years, it's assumed that you did it to avoid Medicaid, which is usually the case.
That's that look-back period.
Look-back period.
Right.
And it's now 60 months.
Okay.
See, when I started, it was like 2 years.
Right.
So it's really increased. That's problematic. There is some things where you can do, and one of the things you got to look at too, I don't want to get too complicated, but when you make those gifts, you don't get a step up in basis. Let me give you an example. Let's say you have a house that parents bought for $20,000. It's now worth $100,000. If they gift it to their children, and the children then sell it later on, there's an $80,000 worth of gain,
right.
Capital gain. If the parent holds on to it until death, it gets a step up to the fair market value at death.
Right.
So, you know, you really got to think about which assets and so forth. The next thing you can do, which has had mixed success, is the idea of this. The children are taking care of the parent. They say, we're going to take care of you for the rest of your life.
I hate to interrupt you on this, Bruce,
That's
but we're going to run out of time
Let me just say this in terms of the Medicaid planning, that's almost developing a subspecialty. And you, what you need to do, Gene, is you need to get in there and talk to the lawyer or whatever long before the weekend before you take the
Exactly. Bruce, thank
Again,
you.
Again, planning is the key.
Planning is the key. We'll definitely have you back, Bruce. Yep. Bruce Stout.
I hope you'll come back and join us again.
Happy to do it.
Listeners, thanks so much for being with us this morning for Planning for Tomorrow. Have a great, wonderful Labor Day weekend.
This is your home for Viewpoint with Gene Dean. Super Talk, 94.1 FM and AM 930 WRVC, Huntington.